Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Dallas, I'm right here. Dallas, I'm right here.
Welcome to the Psychovertical Podcast. It's me, Andy Kirkpatrick, back again. I've got my squeaky chair here, sorry. I've got a bit of a cough. I've got this weird cough. I seem to have had it for ages. I hope I'm not dying. I thought it'd gone, now it's come back again. So the kids might wake up soon, because it's, what time was it? It's like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So I've just zoomed back from wherever I was. And the topic for this podcast is, it's off the top of my head, so I'm gonna have to think as I'm doing it. Why people fail, and I guess the flip side is like how people succeed with the things they do. So someone asked me this question today, like why do people fail, and so I thought I'd like, instead of writing, try and write something down to have some notes, I'll just think off the top of my head. So why do people fail? I think probably the number one thing might be time. Is that if you give something like a unlimited time or just like a lot of time, then often it gives you enough of a window to succeed. So if you wanted to say, the extreme example is like you want to free climb the nose. So if you go there and you have maybe like 40 years, you know, you go there and you're 16 and you can live in Yosemite for the next 40 years or maybe 30 years. So by the time you're in your mid-30s, if you've been climbing 5 days a week in Yosemite, you'll probably be good enough to be able to free climb the nose. Like as long as you've got any sort of genetic problems, you know, like your fingers are too big or whatever, then, you know, you're probably able to do it. So in the sort of medium term, like I think a few times where I've been successful at things I've not been successful in the past is, so I remember when I went to try and solo the troll wall. So the first time I was kind of, I think I just went for like 2 weeks or something, and I had no transport, and it was a bit of a disaster. Like the troll wall is not that easy to get to without a car. There isn't any public transport, so it didn't work out well. And then the second time I went, I probably went for a little bit longer, and did I go in the winter time? I can't remember now, but I went well in the springtime. But again, I still didn't have any transport, so I ended up sort of getting a taxi from the town to the wall and walking backwards and forwards, and that was a complete disaster again. And then the third time I drove from the UK, so I packed up all my stuff and I drove all the way from the UK through the Channel Tunnel, up through Belgium, Holland and all that kind of stuff, went across on the ferry, across to Norway, drove all the way up to Andalsnes, or what it's called, Romsdal. And I basically didn't have to come back until I'd done it. So I didn't have any return ticket. So I just rocked up. I had a transport. I had all the stuff I might need. I had camping stuff. I had my bike. I had everything. And, you know, within 10 days, I'd kind of, I probably took like a week of like ferrying stuff backwards and forwards, but it's much easier to ferry your stuff from your car, like parked near the bottom, than trying to ferry it from a town that's, you know, like 20 miles away or something. And yeah, like although I didn't get to the top, although I was like 15 meters short, I had like I felt like I'd climbed it, and as good as I was going to climb it. So it kind of taught me, that probably taught me a lesson in that you can throw your money at all sorts of things, but you can't, you know, you can't manufacture time. You have to sort of, you know, front load it into your, you know, into your planning. And I think I see that a lot with climbers who, probably the place where I'm most exposed to people failing is probably climbing in Yosemite, where if you hang around the bottom of the nose, you'll probably see, you know, two or three teams failing every single day, like in the height of season. And I would say a lot of them fail because they run out of time, because they started too late. And you know, say you go there and you've got like 2 weeks, which is, I have been to Yosemite. I've climbed El Cap in a week, as in I've, you know, arrived on Monday, climbed El Cap, left on Monday, and I've sort of taken people up El Cap who, you know, you meet them on Monday, climb El Cap, and they're off on Monday. But you generally, I would say like 2 weeks to climb El Cap is the minimum. And you also, the day after you arrive, you kind of have to be on El Cap climbing. So a 3 week trip is much better. Like a 4 week trip is even better. Although the longer the trip sometimes is a negative, because you feel like you have a lot of time. So then you don't get on with it. And then before you know it, your time's run out. Like, you almost have more time if you go for a week than you have if you go for a month, because when you go for a week, you have no alternative but to get on with it and get it done. Where if you go for a month, you can wait a week and fanning on, and then you can try it and you can fail, you come back down. Then before you know it, you only have a week left. So you know, if you just get on it, it would have been fine. So I often say to people, whatever you're doing, is if you think it's a holiday, you know, you have to have your holiday at the end of your trip, not the start of your trip. So if you know, and often it can be literally you have one conversation with somebody, you know, you waste an hour at the campsite talking to somebody or doing something pointless, and that sets that hour or those 2 hours or that half a day is what completely destroys the entire enterprise. You know, you get up at 5 o'clock, or you get up at 7:30 when the sun comes up, rather than 4:30, and it means that when you get to the bottom, there's a team just in front of you. You know, if you'd set off at if you got up at 4:30, you would have been in front of them, and these people just like fuck up your whole climb because they're slow and they're crap and they're not conscious about how slow and crap they are to let you go past. Maximizing, giving yourself the most amount of time, and then maximizing the time you have, are like really, really important. And so I'm a big fan of, like, if you're somewhere where you, you know, like if you kind of, when you're in a lot of places, if you're like camping, you tend to, your rhythm is the rhythm of the sun, when the sun goes up and when the sun goes up and comes down. So it's not, you know, you can easily be asleep by 9 o'clock, and then so waking up at 4:30 is not that a big a deal. But if you're like partying till 3 o'clock and then you have to get up at 4:30, then you know, not only does it screw up that day because you're probably not going to get up, but it could easily screw up like several days because you're just going to be fatigued. So I'm a big fan of, like, you know, I'm not here to have a good time. Like, if you were going, you know, if you're going to the Alps and you have 2 weeks, then, you know, partying hard some après ski for the first week is not kind of conducive. You need to do all that at the end when you've got your you got your objective done. And like in Patagonia, there was always, you know, there's this thing that, you know, if you set off in bad weather, it can only get better. where if you set off in good weather, it can only get bad. And that applies to a lot of places. Like if you're, you know, you go somewhere and there's some bad weather coming, you know, often instead of waiting for 4 days for that weather to come and clear, sometimes you're better just to set off while the weather's still good and then just hunker down for like that day or that half a day or even an hour of some bad weather and then carry on going. And so, you know, Yosemite is a classic case for that, where, you know, you have one raindrop on the weather forecast and everyone just bails off all the routes because they're terrified of a bit of rain. And then the rain comes and it literally rains for like half an hour, if that. And you'll see people, they've spent like 3 days getting high on El Capitan on the nose or something. And then suddenly a bit of rain and they'll all just be bailing down. And the you know, they've only abseiled like one pitch and the sun comes out. But once people start going down, they tend not to go back up again. So they all come back down and it's very tragic. So you know, there's been several times where you knew there was some bad weather coming, but you were prepared for it. You had like a portal edge, you had, you know, portal edge fly sheet, you had, you know, really good storm gear, so you could just hunker down. You know, you can fix your ropes up or whatever. You can make the most of the time you have rather than waiting for like the sort of perfect time. I think in the Alps and places like that, often it's, you know, if you can get from the valley, which is always the hardest part, you get from the valley to close to the route, whether you're sleeping in a hut or sleeping in a tent or somewhere you can bivvy, then, you know, you can be ready to go the second the weather's, you know, the weather's good. And I generally much prefer to be up in the mountains ready at the start of a route rather than down in the ground, you know, down on the ground in the valley where you just end up getting sidetracked and spending loads of money and sitting in the pub and talking about climbing rather than doing it. So I think, so you always have to be conscious of the time, like maybe you need to get yourself like one of those sand dial things, and you just got to be aware that the sand is going out. No matter what you do, the time is passing. And when we were climbing on this last trip, you know, I was so conscious of making the most of that time, even though it was like a month. You know, I was aware that I wanted to get as much done as possible. So almost for the entire month, I was like getting up at 4:30 and I was, you know, I didn't spend any time. I didn't go to camp 4, didn't do anything, or I was like hanging out with people. Because you hang out, you know, you sit in the deli and you'll meet somebody, you'll start talking to them. Before you know it, like the whole afternoon's gone and you said, oh, I was going to carry some water in, I'll have to do it tomorrow. And then that failure to carry something in means that you end up putting the climb off for a day. And then like on Native Sun, we topped out within an hour of topping out. There was a massive like rainstorm that would have really stopped us in our tracks from finishing the route, and that would have really scuppered, you know, we would have been a day behind getting down. We would have been, like, as it was, we just managed to get down in time to get our flights. So, you know, each little thing is compounded, you know, so 3 or 4 late starts or false starts or failure to start, you know, for that day or something, they all like compound into the future. So yeah, so if you want to be successful, be very aware, go there and run. Like in Patagonia, I remember reading someone said you have to hit the ground running, and that's probably true of like a lot of things. Like some objectives you need to, you know, it depends what you're doing. Like if you're just going cragging, doesn't really matter. But if you have an ultimate goal, like everything you do every single day should be, you know, working towards that goal to fulfill it. So even if you're doing something else, like, you know, trying to work out how to get down from the route, or, you know, just like I had a message this week from someone who said they went to do that North America wall in El Cap when I was up there soloing, and they didn't manage to do it because it was too hot. But I was saying how just like carrying all your stuff into the base of a route, knowing where the base is, knowing what the approach is like, knowing how hard it is, knowing what you can carry. Like, I think like a good load for carrying is about 25 kilos. So if you, you know, like if you take, if you carry, try to carry 35 kilos in or more, you know, you just screw yourself over. And you, like, it, if you carry 25 kilos of weight, you could probably do that three times in a day. Where if you're carrying in, you know, like 45 kilos, you might only be able to do that once, and then you're wasted. And also there's a much higher chance that you're going to injure yourself, like sprain your ankle or do something, you know, do something that's going to spoil your climb. So even if this person was unsuccessful on that trip, then it was still a good use of their time, because they, you know, now when they go back, they know exactly what it's going to be like, the amount of work to do it. And I think the often it's the starting is that it's always easier not to start than it is to start. You know, it's always easier to do something else rather than what you're supposed to be doing. And, you know, there's I won't name any names, but there's like people you meet in Yosemite and they spend their entire, literally they'll spend a month just packing and putting things in bags and taking things out of bags and carrying things up and then carrying more things up. Like literally carrying up like hundreds of liters of water and fixing the ropes higher and higher and higher and higher up the wall. And you know what's the, I think Steve Schneider said, like, fix high, party low. But it, you know, you are really better just to spend a good long day getting all your gear to the bottom of El Cap, and then the next day just start climbing. Like, you know, fixings can be handy, but you know, until you start, you've not started. So the sooner you start, the sooner you can, you know. And if you, like often you will have reasons to come down, like some things don't work out, so you have to come back down again. But, you know, on the descent from a climb, you'd be like, I'm never doing this again, I'm never going climbing again. But give it a few hours, a few days, you'll want to go back, and actually it'll strengthen your desire to go back, because you now know there's a few of the unknowns that you know now. So again, like giving yourself enough time to retreat at least once and then go back, you know, that makes a huge difference. Other reasons to fail, weather again is tied into time. Like if you could turn up in the Alps in January and you could have, you know, like 20 foot of snow everywhere, terrible weather, fjorn winds, all that kind of stuff, and nothing's happening. And if you've got like 4 weeks, by the end of those 4 weeks, all the snow could be perfect. The high pressure's arrived. So you, by having more time, you can wait out that time. And then waiting is a real skill. Like how you wait without getting too frustrated, how you can maintain your motivation is like a really top skill that people don't really talk about. And some people can just sort of gestate really well. They can just sit around, they can go skiing or hiking or, you know, go on the train somewhere, or go down to the city, sit in cafes, read books. Have other things to do, where other people, they just get too frustrated and they're probably more likely to either just go home or to do something like stupid, like trying something when it's in dangerous condition or too difficult to get there or whatever. So probably like one of the most important skills, like what's that one about, you know, like the three most important things an alpinist needs is like tenacity, short memory, and I can't remember the third one. And but patience, yeah, like patience is like really, really, really important. I would say like patience, if you want to live a long life as a climber, then patience is probably the most important aspect of your personality to develop. And and you know, you're playing like a very, I need to have a drink of tea. You're playing like a very long game as a climber. Like you know, like you can often feel like it's like years or months have gone past between you know, your desire to do something and actually doing it. But often it's much shorter than that, especially when you have kids. Like, you feel like you're completely, your virginity as a climber is like growing back because you had a baby or something. You've not been climbing for like 6 months, but it is only 6 months. You know, you live a long life. So, you know, so the example of going back to the troll wall like 4 times until I got to the top of the route is an example of like, it's tenacity, but it's also like patience of just thinking, you know, every time you try it, you're like learning more things and you're like arming yourself for your eventual sort of success of getting this thing done. So it's like a process. It's not all about going there and doing it. And if you're not going to do it, then if you keep banging your head against it, at least make sure you're learning something in the process, like some things, you know, going into your head. But so patience is thinking, you know, you go to, so the, again, like back to Yosemite, you go to Yosemite, you have all these ambitions, you go there, doesn't turn out right, you know, your partner doesn't want to carry on, you don't want to carry on, like the hauling's too difficult, the weather's not very good, people tell you things, put you off, the big LCAP looks higher than you thought it did, you know, your travel plans get messed up, your bags get lost for a few days, you get there, you don't think you have enough time after 4 days of thinking what else to do, you realize you did have time, but now you've wasted 4 days. And then before you know it, you know, your trip's over and you're going home. So I think it's, if you sense you're going to fail, then either like redouble your efforts and don't fail, or make the most of it, make the most of the time. Like if you're like, we came here to climb the nose, we've been here 7 days, maybe we can do it, but I don't think we can, so let's just do some of the best routes, rock climbing routes in the valley for the next 7 days. Let's really enjoy it rather than just being, do you get people, this is like a boy man thing, you know, you get someone who really fancies someone, like a young guy really fancies a woman, and the woman knows the guy really fancies her, but she doesn't really fancy him, but they just, the guy just kind of like traipses around behind them, like hoping one day, you know, that something will happen, but it never will, like end up copping off with the guy's best friend or something. And it's a bit like that. It's a bit sad. Like if once you realize you're not going to cop off with El Cap, you should just, you know, cop off with something your own size, something, you know, something that like, kind of doable, like know your place. But so you just make the most of the time, like, so, and just also be realistic. You know, understand your limitations. Like you wanted to climb El Cap, but you don't think, now you've tried it, you don't think you can do it. You know, there's something missing. You can either go away and develop that, or just decide that wasn't for you after all. Yeah. So weather is. I think weather is one of the most frustrating things about, especially alpinism. The good thing about big wall climbing is, like Steve House once called it, like guaranteed outcome climbing. Now, anything where you invest that much time and effort and suffering is more likely to be more guaranteed an outcome. So if you're going up Nanga Parbat with oxygen, you know, with just what's on your back, you and your partner with no fixed ropes, you know, you are, the chances of success are minimal and chances of dying are maximal. Where if you're going up Nanga Parbat and you have like 30 days kit and a whole bag and port ledges, and there's like a team of 4 of you, and you have, you know, you're like capsule style, your chance of success, they're also, I'd say they were almost equivalent, but the chance of dying are kind of minimal. So you, and also you can stay up there for 30 days, so you can go, you know, so climbing up Trango Tower in that style, you know, you're very likely to do it, as long as you can keep on going. So like alpine style stuff, where you only have like 2 or 3 days food and, you know, minimal stuff. Like you're always trying to climb, you know, he's trying to find that weather window where he can get up and down, or at least get up before the bad weather comes. So it can be like incredibly frustrating, like the most frustrating thing in the world. You know, you're sitting in the valley and you're seeing this weather forecast coming in, and you feel like you need a few days for the snow to stabilize or whatever, and then before you can start to approach the route, some more weather's going to be coming in, and you know, it's like really, really frustrating. So sometimes when it's like that, you're just best going ice climbing or do something else instead. But like alpinism is really like one of the most frustrating things. Like, I think you're really better to, if you want to go rock climbing, you know, personally, I think if you want to go rock climbing, go somewhere where you can go rock climbing in like semi-alpine places where the weather's perfect. So you could go like Red Rocks in the wintertime, Yosemite, you know, there's all sorts of places, Squamish, where there's a bit wet sometimes, but Squamish. You know, just like big, long, multi-pitch rock routes where you have like easy access and good weather. And if you want to go ice climbing, you know, then go somewhere where there's like stable weather, good conditions, like Canada, Norway, you know, like places like that. Just go ice climbing. And if you want to go mountaineering, again, go somewhere. It's like you've got like stable weather, you know, like sort of like, you know, South America or somewhere, or, you know, Nepal or somewhere like that. You know, somewhere where you have some like stable weather, stable conditions, and you can just do it. So, you know, like going places where the weather's like really unstable and the climbing's kind of, there's no easy climbing, you know, like Patagonia and places like that, you know, New Zealand, it's like just tough. It's just like a place to go and just get really frustrated. So yeah, you want to get up a few climbs. So weather is a thing, but that potentially could be removed by time, having some more time, and thinking over a long time. Like eventually, you'll always. If you look, you know, if you're keeping a good eye on the weather forecast, so like climbing in Scotland is a good example. If you keep a good eye on the weather forecasts, which are pretty good these days, you can just book your ticket or get in your car or whatever and just get there for some good weather. Where if you're going to climb in Alaska, it's kind of harder to know if you're going to get like a few weeks of good weather. You can just go in a period where you've got high probability and then just be motivated to... Sometimes you have to go, you have to move in bad weather, but you just have to be, you just have to know that where you're moving to and through is a safe place to be in bad weather. You don't want to get like wiped out by an avalanche or something. you know, so there's times when there's like routes you can do in bad weather, and there's routes you don't want to do in bad weather. You know, there's routes that have approaches which aren't avalanche prone. You can just almost get right to the bottom of them and you climb it in crappy conditions. And there's other routes that you can't. So, and a lot of it comes down to like experience of knowing what the routes are. Like sometimes routes, you can't go down them. You can't descend because they're too dangerous to descend, too avalanche prone sometimes. But then again, you could just abseil back down the route you climbed up. Like if you really want to climb something, there's all sorts of, you know, I remember I did a route in Scotland where I think it was like grade 5 or whatever it is, like highest level of avalanche condition, avalanche conditions. But we knew we could walk to the top of the climb without going near any dangerous slopes. So we just like walked up and then we abseiled down the climb from the top and then just climb back up again and then walk back down. So There's often ways of doing things, but you need to have a little bit of like insider knowledge, you know, when to do that. So another thing is, I guess money is a big thing. The more money you have, the more free money. You know, if you have a problem, you just have to hose it down. You know, like if you, you know, so for me, I think hiring a car cost me an absolute fortune, but I was, that's how when I was in America, like it literally gone up, it's sort of literally doubled the price it used to be since COVID. So, but I'm there by myself. If I have to try and get all my soloing gear, like 3 haul bags to Yosemite by myself on public transport, I could easily waste like 2 or 3 days. That's like I could waste a whole week. So I could waste, you know, like 25% of my time. So by hiring a car, like, it's going to cost me lots of money. Well, that's offset by the fact that I probably don't spend any money when I'm in Yosemite. It allows me to like arrive at 12 o'clock in the afternoon, and by midnight I'm in Yosemite, and allows me to get down off the route at midnight, and by 6 in the morning I'm back in California, back in the airport. So, but if I didn't have the money, I wouldn't be able to buy that. I wouldn't be able to do that. So, you know, as you get, the older you get, the more you have more, ideally you have more free money. So before, I think the first time I saw the Del Cap, I did the whole thing, just got on the bus and the train. You know, it was like a total ball ache, but, you know, you did it, and I mean, it didn't have any alternative really. So, yeah, so all sorts of things, having money makes it easier if you drop some important bits of rack, or you suddenly have to buy a whole bag, or you just have to buy new rope, or you blah, blah, blah. If just buying that isn't a big deal, then that's, you know, that's great. but that's not easy for lots of people. So, but yeah, I know on like any kind of trip, just hosing a problem down with money is the way to deal with it. I think preparedness for what you want to do. So you see, again, back to Yosemite, I see a lot of people who are failing to climb the El Cap, the nose, because they've failed to prepare properly, or they're not prepared properly. So as in they've thought too much about how to get good at crack climbing. So they've spent like 6 months climbing every crack they can find until they're, you know, like pretty solid on the cracks. They've done like a little bit of dumarring, you know, spent like a day dumarring somewhere, and they've done like half an hour of hauling a haul bag, but without any weight in it. And so that means that, probably the biggest thing that's going to fuck you up trying to climb El Cap is probably hauling. So that's the thing, you've done the least amount of, not climbing the cracks, you know, so that's the thing that's really going to, that's why people fail, because they climb the first pitch, you know, super quickly because they're good at, you know, climbing that kind of thing. And then it takes their partner, who's had like half a day of dumarring practice, he takes like twice as long to dumar the pitch, and he makes a complete dog's dinner of it, and, you know, almost dies because one of the dumars pops off or whatever. And then they try and haul, and it takes them 10 times as long to haul the haul bag up. So they've got it all about tit, really. Like, you should spend, you know, like several solid sessions hauling, learning to haul, and should spend an equal amount of time learning to dumar, like dumar on a free hanging rope, dumarring on a slab, dumarring on a vertical wall, dumarring with a rucksack on, dumarring, you know, like every form of dumarring you can do, dumarring with a gree-gree, dumarring with two dumars, and all that kind of stuff, until you have it down. You don't have to make it complicated. You just have to be really good at doing the basics of it. Like, you need to be, you know, like, you just need to have a good base of knowing how to do it, so that when you start doing it for real, you're not just wasting loads of time learning how to do it, you know. So once you've dumarred a rope for like 500 meters up El Cap, you'll be pretty good at dumarring. And the same, once you've hauled 5 pitches, you'll be pretty good at hauling. But if you don't know how to do either of those things, you're just going to waste so much time and get so frustrated that you're probably not going to do the route. You're never going to get good at it, because you're just going to bail after one pitch. So, like, I saw these guys, there was 3 of them, they're trying to haul this haul bag up, and it was just painful. It was like absolutely painful. You know, you've got, first of all, you've got 3 guys up there. One guy's trying to do like a leg haul, because he'd like read that's how you do it in like some sort of Royal Robbins book from like 1960s, you know. So he didn't know how to, he's just doing it completely wrong, like completely inappropriate to the load. You know, you've got like 2 extra people there who could be counterbalancing the whole bag, doing like a space haul, and the bags could be up there in super quickly, and you know, they're also like hauling in the middle of the afternoon when it's like roastingly hot, and they just kind of do everything wrong. And then when I saw them later on when they'd bailed, I was like, did you never like practice hauling? And they said, we did, but we didn't put any weight in the haul pack. You know, so that's, you know, you're just not where you, it's like practicing swimming, but without going in the water. Do you know what I mean? Just like laying on the floor and like flapping around. So yeah, so you really, you need to take, like, don't be a fucking amateur. Like, if you're going to do something difficult, then practice like you're robbing a bank or something, or you know, you need to really work. You need to go through all the skills, and you need to practice them all and get them to a level which is a basic level of competency, and then take them onto the objective and do it that way. Because you can learn, you learn so much when you're climbing. So if you're the first time you go like mixed climbing, you know, or ice climbing, there's lots of stuff you've read, and suddenly it'll all kind of make a lot more sense. You know, like when you put an ice axe into a piece of...
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Ice and like dinner plates, and then you take it out and you put it in again, and you pull on it and the dinner plate comes off, and your ice axe flies out and all that kind of thing. Like, that's what dinner plating is, or that's what, you know, all these kind of little things you've kind of learned. So being prepared, and I think also maybe being prepared mentally is important as well. Like, you have to have you'd have to be humble in the face of what you're going to do. You have to be confident. You need to have like a quiet confidence that you're fit enough, and you've got the skills, and you've got the equipment, and you've got the knowledge, and you've got a good team, you know, a good partner, good partners, and you've got some time, and everything, the weather, you've got a good weather forecast. If you put all those things in place, you know, the reason you're going to fail probably is you were meant to fail, like you're shit or something. So adopting like a humble, you know, if you think you're going to be like Superman, if you think you're going to be like Alex Honnold, and you're going to just like be free soloing up there with the rope tied to you, and you know, the first move your foot slips off and you land on your ass, you know, that's going to bring you down to the earth, to the point where like, oh, this is shit, I can't do this, or it's too slippery or something. You know, you need to be like, oh, I thought it was going to be really hard, and it is. So you just need to take that kind of, like, you're almost easier. It'd be easier to climb a big wall with someone who had never been climbing before but had the right attitude. You're like a plasterer or somebody, or somebody, you know, like someone has got, you know, you just, someone who just puts in the work, like just put in the work, you know, day after day after day, you know, low expectations, and just grind it out. You know, you need to kind of adopt this like a sort of a rhino-y, you know, like a stubborn, like, this is my job. Do you know what I mean? You know, you're like, this is what my job is. My job is to climb El Cap, and that's what I'm going to do. You know, and no matter what happens, as long as I'm still alive, I'm a all my limbs are working, that's what I'm going to do, you know. And I might be slow, but there's people who are faster than me who passed me out, but they've all gone back, they've all bailed, you know. So it's just that kind of like a workman-like attitude to what you're doing. And that applies to anything. Like, some people can be very flashy and tell you how great they are, but it's that kind of quiet confidence, is that I might be shit, you know, but I could be shit all day. You know what I mean? So that's kind of Warren Harding. That's why I think Warren Harding's one of my heroes, because that's why he's kind of, you know, he was like basically worked on the roads. He was like a, you know, like a blue collar kind of climber. So that was, you know, he's one of my heroes. So that's the kind of climbing I like blue collar climbing, where you just, I quite like the work, you know, the climbing's okay, but I quite like that feeling of like slowly making something happen, like small incremental steps. Like I've only carried this, you know, all today is like I've carried this water to the base, but the water's there now, and then tomorrow I'll do this, and everything you do is in aid of the thing you want to get done, you know. So it's a real, for me, I find that really, really satisfying. It's not about, you know, getting like shit hot and just making it all about me. It's like, especially when there's a team of people and you're all working together. So that's important. So another thing I'd say is someone has to be in charge, even if you're by yourself. There's a climbing co-op here in Galway, and someone's complaining that the problem with the co-op is no one's in charge. You need someone with like the vision and the drive and to get shit done and motivate people to be better than they think they are and to see things in them they don't see themselves. So it's often easier in a partnership for one person to be a lot better, not better, but like be more experienced than the other person, because they can see that maybe the other person is better than they are, or younger or stronger or whatever, more stupid. So they kind of, they give the impression they're in charge and they tell that person what to do or what they can't do. But really the other person is leading they're like the engine and the other person's like the steering wheel. Like, without either bits, nothing's going to happen. You're not going to get anywhere. So, but often in partnerships, like if two people are completely equal and no one decides who's in charge, then that can be a negative. Like I remember, so Paul Ramsden, who I've been on like several trips with, like the Alps and Patagonia and Alaska and places, like who I think he's won like the Pile d'Or like six times. Like I think we were terrible partners, because I think we're similar age. And he is a lot more, like, he has a lot more experience than me, like, a monumental amount of experience, probably more experience than almost any climber I've ever met. But he probably doesn't feel like that. He probably thinks I have lots of experience, or had lots of experience. And we kind of, like, cancelled each other out. You know, you got, like, a wave form. Like, sometimes if you get two waves, they kind of cancel each other out. And it was a little bit like that, really, because neither of us felt comfortable to to like boss the other one around, or say like we have to do this or we have to do that, or where if you were with you know, when on other trips where we've been with people who weren't so experienced, but they were like fit and strong and young and all that kind of stuff, like it worked really well, because you were in charge and you had enough drive or experience to know that if we keep doing what we're doing now, we're going to succeed. But also you had enough experience to know that there's factors going on that we can't overcome, so we have to go back down again. So you know, often like that kind of experience is like really, really important. But yeah, someone has to be, like, often when you have a team of three, like one person will be more negative, one person will be more positive as in delusional. Then one person will tend to be like the balance of the two. I think there's like something about like North Koreans, when they sent North Korean sort of teams over into South Korea in the war, they would always be a three, because you would always end up with a decision. You know, if it came down to making a decision, like three people are more able to make a decision compared to four people or two people. You know, like two people can have a stalemate and four people can have a stalemate. But with three people, generally, you're going to come up with a decision, if that makes any sense. So I think that's kind of true, like in a team. It's harder. You really have to have like quite a big difference between two people for one person to be more experienced. But that, to be like the boss, that doesn't mean that they are the boss, but that means that they're the one who is going to have a little bit more of a thumb on the scale of what to do. So when I, like the second trip, when I went to Yosemite, I went with Andy Perkins, who was like a real like hero of mine. And he'd climbed in the Himalayas and like really good rock climber, really good big wall climber. So he was, although he was like a lot more experienced than me and he was like a lot older than me, I think in my mind, I think I thought I had more experience at climbing hard, big walls than he did, even though that might not have been true. But in my head, that was true. So that's what really matters. And so we ended up being quite, I think we were quite a good team because he was more like, he was happy, you know, like go on youth, you do that scary pitch or something and just sit back and let me do it. You know, and he was kind of in charge. Like if he said something, that's what we did. I mean, if I said something, you know, we'd probably, you know, debate it and then he would do what he thought. So I think that's why maybe in the past, like, you know, like doing an apprenticeship with a more experienced climber is a really good thing because they, you know, they can maximize your fitness and drive and energy, and they can sort of, you know, like direct it better. And even when you're soloing, you need a little bit like that. Like someone has to be in charge. Like internally, you've got all your different, you know, yourselves, your past self, future self, present self, and all that kind of stuff. But you have your weak self, and you have your strong self, and you have your kind of, you know, like sort of middling self. But you, you know, sometimes you have to have that strong part of your character. You can construct like an emoji. What do you call it? A thing, you know, you construct like a familiar. You can construct something, you know, inside you that is a manifestation of the strength of yourself, and you can use that as like a totem or whatever, you know, telling you what to do and listen to that. But you also have to listen to your weak side, you know, let that chime in and see what that says. But but someone's got to be in charge, even if it's you. So fitness is important depending on what you're doing. I think sometimes in the past I failed because I wasn't fit enough. Like I would spend a lot of time on stuff that probably was important, but I would neglect my fitness. So you want to go away feeling as fit as you can be for the amount of time you've got to train for it. And often that doesn't actually really mean anything. Like your motivation and your mental strength is really what really counts, but it's hard to develop that. It seems that takes a long time to develop. So, but you know, a physical fitness, physical strength can bolster that whatever you've got in your head. It can bolster, but also can like undermine it. If you go away feeling really fat and unfit and, you know, out of condition, then that's going to undermine your, you know, your kind of your drive and determination and feeling get something done. So have a good, you know, work, have a plan, like work towards, you know, you're going away on X date, like try and get a spreadsheet and try and work out like a training plan, you know, go running every other day, go to the gym every other day, try and taper it towards like your objective without getting injured or anything. Like don't go like off the crazy, like straight off the start. Like you need to sort of build up to strength, and then eventually you want to go away like feeling, ideally you want to feel like, oh, this is the strongest or the fittest I've ever been, if you're going to do something hard. And if you want to go and climb the West Butchers of Denali or something, you know, you want to go away feeling, you know, like you can carry heavy loads and you've got good cardio and all that kind of stuff. What else? Why do we fail? Partnerships. Like, you again, like back, add on to like who's in charge. You need to have like a good partnership with somebody. Like you can almost have as good a partnership with a stranger as you can with a friend, really, or someone you've known for a long time. You know, like people will often climb together, but they wouldn't socialize together. You know, you could have completely different views on lots of different things, but you just kind of get on well when it comes to climbing. So I think like Mick Fowler and Victor Saunders are probably a bit like that, like very different people. You know, one's an accountant and one's like a poet, warrior poet. But they, you know, they climb together well because they have the shared, you know, passion for climbing, and they have a shared, you know, view of style and how it should be done, and it works really well. So, you know, you want people, to me, I'd say you want people who aren't moody. That's like number one. You know, moody people are, you don't want drains, you want radiators, you don't want people who are negative. Like, you want people who are pragmatic and like realists, but you don't want people who are just like negative. You know, like I've said this before, but you know, some climbs and some people, they're just failure waiting to looking for an excuse. You know, like they'll just like drag you down because for some reason, you know, they're lacking something, and they're just looking for a reason rather than accept it's something they've done or they're lacking. They're always looking for a reason that it's like your fault or the fault of the climb or the fault of the weather, whatever. But often it's like something inside them that's, you know, that's not probably not for them, whatever they're doing. Yeah, like people who, it's like a sense of humor, I think, is like really important. I think people who are like honest, I think people who are willing to say sorry. Like when I was climbing this year with Tom, like, you know, like I'm out of my comfort zone. Like, I've not climbed a big wall for like a few years, and I get scared like anybody else, and I get tired like everybody else. I get irritable like everybody else. So, you know, when you like have a short word with somebody, like when someone's like, we do like a tension traverse, like that person's like lowering the rope out, and if they lower a bit too much rope out and I'm a bit short, like, stop, what are you doing? You know, afterwards you have to be able to say, oh, I'm really sorry I said that, like I was just being a bit of a knobhead. And being open, like trying to empathic, like, you know, understand when your partners are struggling or they're afraid or they have doubts, you know, try to strengthen each other. You know, like two people leaning against each other are quite strong rather than one person just like, you know, trying to lean against nobody else. And people who are like, can just make it fun. Like, if it's all just like death, you know, you know, it's just not, you know, you go climb a Kendall Kurtz, you know, from a Apocalypse Now, you know, it's not going to be that much, you know, I'm like, this is like a, you know, a slug on a razor blade or something, you know, that's not that much fun, you know. So, and I think like when you find like a good partner and you have a good time and you have a positive experience, being successful doesn't really make as much difference, really. Like, if it's a real grind and you're not enjoying being with this person, then the only like upside is getting to the top. That was what made it worth it. But if you have like a good laugh and you know you give it your best and you enjoy being with this person, then getting to the top is a bonus. I guess it's back to that thing, like, you know, there's three Moantuanism. There's, you know, the three most importance of a trip is to come back alive, come back friends, and come back successful. Personally, I'm not so bothered about the second one. No. So finding those partners is not easy. It's almost like by chance. You could go to Yosemite, you could meet someone in the car park. You know, you could go up the wall, it could be fantastic. Or you could have known someone all your life, you go to the wall, it's fucking terrible. So, you know, again, like having a bit of time, like going climbing with somebody beforehand, go and do like some rock routes with them, see how you get on, let them know what you're like, you can know what they're like, see if they're what they like in the morning. Like, you know, getting up at 4:30 in the morning is a good test of somebody. Doing a really long day, you would get up at 4:30 in the morning, get back at midnight, like, how is the person? Are they still motivated? Are they still, you know, like, really pay attention to really small details. Like, are they safe? Like, do they hold the rope properly? You know, do they do the screw gates up? All those kind of little things. And although I'm a terrible like person for like talking about climbing and probably being a total bullshitter and all that kind of stuff, just always be conscious with people who are trying to give the right impression that they're like something they might not be. Because often those people, you know, once you get them to the wall, the wall or the climb or the face or the route, like that's all that bullshit that doesn't matter, you know, no matter what you think about yourself or say about yourself, when you're actually doing it, it's the action that counts. So if someone is not, you know, someone tells you like they climb E5 or 5.13 or something, and you get there and they're just kind of struggling on like on the approach, you know, you're like, is this person, you know, and they're like, oh, actually I meant I climbed 5.13 indoors on a top rope, and you're like, well, what do you climb outdoors, you know, on a lead rope? And they're like, oh, I've never led anything before, I've never climbed outdoors before. So yeah, you really need to test somebody if you don't know, and they need to test you and see how, you know, how honest they are really about their own abilities. But again, you know, someone doesn't have to be super experienced to do what you want to do. They just have to be motivated and fit enough to do it, and just be willing to give it a try. And sometimes you might have to lead everything, you know, and they just have a job. You're the person who's cleaning and hauling, and they'll be like, yes sir, you know, salute. And you know, you'll have to lead everything, and that's the way it goes. So maybe next time they could lead something, you know, like a good partnership. It's an investment for the future. Like, you can find a good partner, develop that partnership, do something hard, and then what we're going to do next year, why don't we do this? Why don't we go to Alaska? Why don't we go to the Nepal? Or, you know, and you often you'll cultivate like several partnerships like that. Who do you go climbing with? You know, I'll climb with this guy. Oh, maybe that guy could come with us as well. And you know, that's how you do it. But it takes work, and it takes, you know, it's like a long term thing. It's not just, you know, rocking up. Like I remember meeting Alex Honnold when he just in the cafeteria, and he'd just been up on the nose with Uli Steck. And I remember him saying that he thought Uli Steck was like too dangerous to climb with. I hope I'm not speaking out of school here. But he basically said he was too gung-ho in the, you know, when you're like simul climbing up a wall, like someone, you know, they climb 60 meters and they put a cam in, and then they start carry on climbing, the other person's climbing behind them. And he said how Uli Steck would like zoom up, like speed up, and you would get and take the cam out when he said this big lump of loop of rope. It was like unnecessary. And so Alex Honnold, who I think most people wouldn't view as being like the safest climber in the world, you know, he, even to him, he was like, that's not very safe, that's too much. So it's those little tiny details. And that's probably why they tried the nose, speed ascent on the nose once, and that was it. They never tried again. So, you know, there's it's horses for courses, really. You'll find someone. It's not like trying to find someone you can shag or something, you know, like someone to get married to or something. You know, it's not quite. It's more than that. It's much more than that. Though it's you know, it's about like finding someone you just get on with. So yeah, did I already tell you that story? Did I tell you the story about my daughter? I think I did tell you the story. You know, about someone I met in the Norwegian army, and he said it's not about how qualified you are. It's like about how if you could just spend like a month with someone in a snow hole, you know, that's the most important thing. So it's, yeah, someone who you could spend like 2 weeks in a tent on the Ruth Gorge, reading books and talking, chatting to, and you know, you won't go mental. So yeah, and most people are kind of like that. There's a few people I've met in my life who I would say like a borderline mental, you know, like psychotic or whatever, that I just couldn't spend any time with. But nobody else could either, so it doesn't really matter. Yeah, like there are some people who are totally delusional and dangerous because they don't. Often people who lie a lot about what they do, they have this thing where they don't realise that people are stupid and they can see through their lies. So yeah, people like that are kind of best. best avoided. But often, like, young climbers don't know that, so they end up going climbing with people who really are a hazard to them and to themselves. So anything else? I guess equipment, like having the right equipment, having the right gear to do what you want to do and to know how to use it, like not rocking up with new gear you've never used before, is kind of important. Having systems, like, you know, how your clothing works, especially in the Alps, you know, you want to have tested out all your gear, you know, how is it when it gets wet, how quick does it dry, can I sit in my sleeping bag with the hood up, or is it the sleeping bag too short, you know, how to put my crampons on, how do I change the picks on my ice axes, all these loads of little things, like what kind of gloves, you know, like a real killer thing is like, you know, what your hand wear, you know, like you need like a glove system that you can like use your, you know, get to your gear and use your gear and put cams in and all that kind of stuff without taking them off. So it's like, you know, if you just rock up and you've never used you just bought these gloves out of the shop and you can't use them properly, then, you know, it could really affect your climb. You'd be dropping gear, or you'd have to take the gloves off and you drop your gloves, or you get, you know, whatever. So there is like an aspect of gear. Like the next climb I'm probably going to do, I'm going to try and solo a route, like an A4 route on the Naranja de Bulnes in Spain. And, you know, like Naranja de Bulnes is limestone. So at the moment I'm like I'm sort of in my head, I'm like going through all the different bits of gear that I might need to get or might need to make or something. And it's like a long approach to get to the bottom of the wall. So I have to carry all my stuff up there by myself. So, you know, so in my head, I'm like working, like what kind of, how many pitons do I need? And I need like soft pitons, not hard pitons, or like a mixture. And maybe I need some lead heads rather than copper heads. And maybe I need some copper heads. Maybe I need some like wooden wedges to stack. Maybe I need to replace some of my tricams that I've lost. You know, tricams could be useful, cams less useful, but I still need some cams. What sort of nuts do I need? So like sort of slowly over like the course of a few months, I'm thinking about, you know, I'm like thinking all what rack I need, you know, how much, what, you know, like what happens if I drop some of the rack, the other rack can replace it from on the wall. Like I'm currently making a new rucksack. I've had this rucksack for years. The design was made up from a Gore-Lite Gust rucksack, and I'm going to make another one, but like a slightly bigger. But I'm going to make it out of like ballistic nylon rather than Cordura or Dyneema or something. And, you know, so I'm sort of making that in mind for this climb, for one of the, you know, carrying really, really heavy stuff up. And I'm going to use one of these like tump lines where it goes over your head like a Sherpa. And so that's why I'm making this sack. So I want it to sort of fit in with this idea of carrying some of the weight on your head. And just like loads of little things. I'm going to make a different sleeping bag, like a homemade sleeping bag for the route. I'm going to make a new bivy bag, like a bivy bag, which is like breathable on the top and the bottom. You know, like an old school Gore-Tex bivy bag before they started using nylon bottoms, which just get really sweaty. And just like loads of little tiny little projects in my head that I'm sort of slowly working towards, you know. So when I finally get to the wall, like there's a lot of things on the climb that you can't control, but there's also lots of things you can control. So if you can control as many of those as you can before you get there, then that's going to make it a lot easier. Like if I, you know, if I didn't know you need like soft pitons, and I get to the bottom of the wall and I've gone all over to Spain and I've done all that hard work and I just find all the rock keeps breaking every time I put a piton in, then, you know, I've failed to prepare for the failed to prepare to climb. I guess it's a bit like that thing, what do you call it, the Day of the Jackal. You know, I'm like an assassin and I'm working towards my target of, you know, I've got my dossier and I'm working through all the, you know, all the little things in my head, how to succeed at climbing this wall. You know, I need to know where I'm going to stay, where I'm going to park, where I'm going to leave my car, how far is it, do I need a map, what's it like in the winter, in the springtime, is there going to be loads of snow, do I need my crampons, will I need an ice axe, how do I get down again? You know, are there any fixed ropes? Do I need to do the descent before I do the climb so I know how to get down? Will the hut be open? Where do I get water from? Should I take dried food? Should I take pasta? If I take pasta, how much fuel will I need? What kind of fuel should I take? Should I take... Do you know what I mean? Like, so there's like a million and one little questions in your head, and you're trying to work through them all to the point where once you get there, all the unknown questions, you know, you have time to think, you have time to answer all those. You know, you don't turn up and your sleeping bag's not warm enough. You know, you're like, oh, it's not winter, but it is actually high up in the mountains and it is like, you know, springtime. So you have lots of little things in your head. You're kind of working through, what if this happens? Do I need could I use a 9mm static rope from a haul line, or is that going to be a bit thin if I'm like, is that a bit scary upping down free hanging, you know, wraps with this on a 9mm static? Or, you know, lots and loads of little things. What kind of belay device will I use? Using my silent partner, which is quite heavy. Will I use a gree-gree? It's like much lighter. You know, all these kind of things. Working towards, I need to, you know, work on my fitness for carrying all that stuff up. I don't want to get like injured or wasted just carrying all that, you know, 25 kilos up there, like several trips up and down, and all that kind of stuff. But sometimes you will fail. Sometimes it's not in your control. Things just don't work out. But you just have to not take it personally. You have to enjoy the journey, really, not the destination. You just need to in the, you know, the planning and the training and the all that kind of stuff. It's all got to be part of it. It's all got to be stuff you enjoy that's part of the adventure and the project. You know what I mean? You know, and if you did it well, and you still can't succeed, it doesn't really matter, because you just roll it all into the next thing. It's all one thing. It's not separate. So, you know, as long as you're learning and you're proving to yourself that you're grafting, then that's, you know, that's all that really matters, really. So yeah, there you go. My kids are awake. They've had the nap. I better go and see them. Anybody has any more questions? A little bit of housekeeping. I've finally managed to get all my Kindle versions of my books to $9.99, whether that's $9.99 or £9.99 or €9.99, through lots of hard work. I've managed to get them all the same price, whether that's, you know, anyway. The Kindle is such a horrible thing to deal with. And it's Amazon, but all the images were in SVG images, which means you have a very low file size, which means that you can charge. It's very complicated. But if you get 70% royalties on a Kindle if the author, but it has to be priced at $9.99. But at $9.99, at 70% margin, you get charged for the size of the file. So like some of the files were like 78 megabytes, which meant even if I sold one, I didn't get any money whatsoever, because the fee of the file size just wiped out any profit. So you can have it unlimited file size, but you only get 35% profit margin. So then you have to sell it for like three times as much to get the same amount of money. So that's why you'll get books like John Long's How to Rock Climb, and it'll be like €27 or something as a Kindle. That's the reason. So trying to get over this, I made all my images SVG images, which are great, because an SVG image is like ultra unlimitedly zooming inable. You know, you can magnify it and it looks the same as you magnify in. So brilliant for diagrams. And Kindle said that's you can use SVG images on a Kindle, but obviously you can't, because they all just came out as black. So you know, someone would buy the book and they would look at the images, it'd all be black. So I had to in like, you spend like, I literally take like a month making all the images SVGs and all my books, and then it doesn't work. So it's a bit, so a Kindle is a bit like a 1990s Internet Explorer. Like, it's basically shit, basically. So anyway, but that's what you have to work with. So I've managed to make all the images tiny, which aren't as, they're not as clear because they have to be a lot smaller than PNGs. But I've managed just to get them all to the point where the I make enough margin. I don't make 70% margin, but I make like enough margin to be worth it. So, and I just made them all $9.99. Like, some books are expensive, but the paperback version, but the Kindle, I just made all the Kindles the same price. So if you want like a version of some of the books, like Down or whatever, then like the Kindle version, you can have it on your phone or whatever. Anyway, so that's my only housekeeping. If anyone wants to support this podcast, probably the best way to do it is to buy gold and buy silver. Yeah, that's the best way to do it. Or Juice Plus, or Viagra, or get a penis extension so you can sit down and piss without. Anyway. If you want to support this podcast, then go to my Substack and be a paid subscriber for Substack. I think it's like $5 a month or something. And so I've just started that again. So I just did a big, long, boring article about socks, about winter socks and about all that kind of stuff. So really exciting stuff. It like rock your world, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So at the moment I'm doing like, doing podcast a week, and I'm doing like a Substack post every week. And usually my Substack followers, they get like dodgy deals, you know, on heroin and stuff. So when I do like a book, I usually do like a dodgy deal for like Substack supporter type people. Anyway, so that's it. If anybody has any ideas for next week's podcast, maybe I'll do one on, it's the winter time, maybe I'll do one about winter climbing, my thoughts on winter climbing. Would that be good? What do you think? Anyway, so until then, stay safe.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.